Welcome to Boston Basic Income. This week's topic is labor demand. So we often discuss how basic income might affect people's willingness or desire to work. That's the labor supply. Labor demand is the extent to which employers want to hire people in the first place. What does it mean for there to be insufficient labor demand, and how does basic income change things? Some of us read an article by Jared Bernstein from 2018 entitled The Importance of Strong Labor Demand. It's a policy paper. Bernstein was the chief economist for Joe Biden back when he was vice president, and he participated in the Intelligence Squared debate about basic income a few years back, which we talked about on here. So the labor market is essentially a market for people's time. People always spend their time doing something, and there's a fixed amount of it. There's a fixed amount of people's time. In aggregate, we can think about there being a fixed quantity of labor whose average price is moving around. But it's also true that at any given price point, there's a certain quantity of labor that employers are willing to pay for at that price. So an increase in the demand for labor can mean that at a particular wage, there are more hours demanded at that wage. Or more generally, if we're thinking about the economy in aggregate, we could say that an increase in labor demand means that the total amount of money that employers are willing to pay out in wages has increased. The question I want to pose to people as we go around the room is, why is labor demand important? Is strong labor demand a good thing? And how does basic income fit into the picture? We'll start with Eddie, and then Neil, and then Richard.
Alex and I talked about this a little bit on previous discussions. In my view, labor demand is absolutely important. It's the weakest link in the economy. And so the perspective that I'm coming from is that, you know, Alex likes to talk about the vending machine analogy of the economy. And I would kind of extend that further and say that it's not just a vending machine. There's a factory in the back. And the factory in the back, it's always growing. The production that it can handle is always growing. And it's made up of capital on one hand, and it also uses all of the labor in the economy on the other hand. And the weak link is that as the capital increases, that reduces the need for labor input. But on the other hand, this is a paradox, because as your need for labor input reduces and the income going to that labor reduces, those worker consumers are also the people who are consuming the output of the machine. And so as productivity growth increases, on the one hand, you can produce more, but on the other hand, you have less need for the people's labor to produce it. And paradoxically, you pay the people less, which means that they have difficulty actually buying and consuming what you're producing. And the primary measure that you can see that this happens is capacity utilization in the economy. And another very key indicator is interest rates in the economy. Both of those have trended downwards from the 80s until now. And if you look further back, they actually trended upwards from the Great Depression into the 70s. And so this is a sort of a cycle that is a self-reinforcing positive feedback loop that runs from consumption to labor income.
Okay, cool. So an interesting question we can explore as we get into this is to what extent that feedback loop exists in a basic income world versus our current world where consumers are getting their income through wages. So let's go to Neil, and then Richard, and then Bethany.
I have a slightly different perspective. I think that in the present economy, we will have less and less need for people to produce goods. However, there is always services we can provide to each other. And the demand for services, as far as I can tell, is very elastic. So in other words, if for some way we had helicopter money and gave people money, they would all attempt to get services from other people. What I have read is, unless you are completely hopeless, there are hopeless people, then you want to work. Maybe not 40 hours a week, but you want to work because it provides a reason for being, and it provides a social ability. It provides a lot of needs of people. So in my view, the economy should slowly increase the amount of services it provides as the need to provide goods by people goes down. In other words, productivity will increase to the point where you can make as many cars as you conceivably would want. So basically, I think that whether you use a basic income or some other device, you should spread the wealth so that people can buy services from each other.
Okay, interesting. Spread the wealth so that people can buy services from each other. Do we want to kind of help the services along so that people can earn money that way? Is that something that might help the economy? Let's go to Richard and then Bethany and then Joan.
The way I see it is that the government allows an increasing number of conglomerates and oligarchies and stuff to buy up smaller companies. And so since the labor of those smaller companies is being added to those, they have so-called duplicate labor. And so they lay it off because they don't need as much. As that keeps going on, there's a need for fewer and fewer jobs. And another thing is that there's automation being thrown into the mix increasingly, like with Flippy being added into a number of White Castle restaurants. The Flippy is an automatic robot that flips burgers, and it also can use the deep fryer. And each time the burger or whatever turns out perfectly. So they invest more and more into automation. There's fewer need for labor.
That's an interesting point. To what extent is there less demand for labor because we've become more productive? And then to what extent is there less demand for labor because there's less demand for the product? That's a distinction we can ask about. Let's go to Bethany and then Joan.
I just want to say a couple of things. One, you might have said already, but something that you say a lot that I think is important here is it might be useful to frame using labor in terms of inputs to a product as a resource, like anything else where we'd want to conserve it or use as little as possible. And I think that's a different framing than we're used to because people also get their money from their labor. So I think that reframes a lot of things in terms of how we're thinking about it. And in terms of what Neil was saying about people wanting purpose and so on, I guess I would just make the distinction between contributing in some way or doing something that feels meaningful, which is often paid, but not always, and paid labor. So I think they're overlapping but distinct concepts in the sense that sometimes what people are paid to do doesn't feel very purposeful or meaningful or rewarding for them. Sometimes it does. And there are lots of ways that people contribute to others or contribute services or other things like that that aren't paid labor. So I usually find it useful to make a distinction between the paid labor versus just making contributions in different ways.
That's an important point. We can think of labor as a resource. Our discussion last week was about resource conservation. Do we really want to be maxing out our use of people's time? At the beginning, I was talking about how people's time, there's a finite amount of it, and they can either spend it doing one thing or they can spend it doing another thing. To what extent do we want to set things up to pull people into doing something else, into spending their time in another way? Do we want everybody to be spending all of their time in a way that's different than what they would choose to do if they didn't need to because they had to earn money or something like that? So I think that's an important question as well. Let's go to Joan.
I was going to speak to Neil's point also, but now also Bethany's point about not factoring in the need for people, not just to feel useful, but to feel that they're actually contributing in the way that other people are contributing. So there are a lot of people who can't make up a meaningful life without a job. And there are a lot of people who feel that they're only normal if they're doing what other people are doing to earn money. And so volunteering, fake jobs that get created that aren't really doing anything real are, I don't think, the answer for those people. And I don't think they're a small amount of people. I think there are a lot of people who feel that to be a full member of society, you need to contribute through the labor market, not through volunteering, not through making up something purposeful in your life, which a lot of people can't do anyway, but through actually contributing labor. So I don't know how big that segment is, but I don't think it's wise to overlook that. And so the idea of making up jobs comes into play here. I mean, we kind of scorn that in here as, well, you know, that's make work or bullshit jobs. But in fact, there may be a reason for doing that other than getting people wages.
I think that's exactly right. And we've talked about this before in here. In order to provide the most benefit to people in our society, in our economy, do we want to put resources into providing activities for people to do? And then, you know, is it a sports club? Is it something that you actually pay to participate in because it's something that benefits you? Or is there something special about having to earn money or having to feel like you're contributing something to the input of the economy or something like that? If that's the case, then we have to do some kind of trickery and actually create work that's not necessary and kind of convince people that it is necessary and that they're contributing to the society and all of that. I don't know that we have to go that far, but I think there are wrinkles like that. You know, you have to provide meaningful activities for people so they can have meaning and purpose in their lives. It's not all going to happen on its own. So that's certainly something we need to pay attention to. Let's go to Bethany. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a response to that, or a couple of responses. One, I think we've talked before, but I think it's useful to separate the issues of what that might occur in the transition to basic income from the issues that might occur once it was established for a long period of time, and there was sort of like a cultural shift around it, perhaps. I'm thinking of the fact that for a long time, aristocracy weren't necessarily expected to have a job. Now, super wealthy people often do still want to have something that looks like a traditional job, although not always. But, you know, there have been periods of time where people did find meaning and purpose without paid labor. But I think, as Joan pointed out, it depends on what other people are doing and kind of like what the culture is. And so I think this is especially an issue in the transition. And I'm more optimistic that after a long period of time, if there were basic income, the culture would kind of shift. And people who grew up in a situation with a basic income and so on might feel differently and might even learn better to create other kinds of purpose besides like a job in their lives, because they would expect that in the first place. And I think you see a little bit of that even in people based on their socioeconomic status, like people who go to Harvard where I teach or something, like they definitely expect to have to work, but there's also a sense that they should be picking something important, that they should be sort of forging a path. And I don't know if everyone maybe doesn't have that, and that might make it harder to like transition, but I think they could have that in a world with a basic income if people were expecting it. Another point that I think Joan and you were talking about too is that we're going to do a better job optimizing the goal of meaning and purpose in people's lives if we're explicit that that's what we're doing. Right now, what we might do is fight automation and then not have as many automatic burger flippers or whatever in fast food restaurants. And then people are doing that with their time, which maybe gives them some meaning and purpose, but probably not optimal compared to other things that people could be doing. So I think it's just really important. It's really helpful to be explicit because the kind of indirect unconscious mechanisms that we use often give people something that at best is mixed, like it gives them a sense of meaning, but it's not great, or at worst really feels like a waste of their time and they would rather use that time other ways and so on.
I like what you said about comparing two different states of the world. So we have our world now without basic income, and we can ask, where is the labor demand coming from in our world without basic income? And you can also ask, what are people's cultural needs? Like, what have they adapted to in terms of needing to feel fulfilled and that kind of thing? And then you can imagine another world that just has basic income and they've had it forever or whatever. And then what do people need to get meaning and purpose in that kind of world? If they're used to having a basic income, then it might not be. I like that Bethany pointed out the transition is difficult because we're used to things working a certain way. But then when things are working another way, eventually culture will adapt to the ways in which that's working. So we might need to put measures in place to facilitate the transition, but maybe some of those measures go away after several generations and people get used to the new way of doing things. We don't have to pretend that people are contributing and earning money anymore, that kind of thing, except to the extent that we actually do have an efficient labor market where we are paying people to do things.
I just wanted to quickly say that we sometimes talk about the government stepping in and trying to help with meaning and purpose, but I think over time, at least, this would happen on a cultural level somewhat naturally. So it's not like people would be on their own necessarily. Joan pointed out, like, not everyone could sort of just all of a sudden on their own, like, figure out how to add structure or meaning to their lives. But I think rather you'd have whatever social institutions and like people to copy and groups to join, or I'm not sure exactly what it would look like, but I think people wouldn't be on their own. I think that it would evolve and probably outside of government to a large extent if there were the need. Maybe not right away, like you said, but over time.
Right. Some of it happens just with people on its own. And then you might need the government to help in some ways or provide some support as people undergo the transition. So I'm going to go to a quote from the article. And this quote is from the beginning of the article. By conventional measures, the U.S. job market has suffered some degree of slack for about 70% of the time since 1980. The absence of persistent, strong labor market demand has a significant negative impact on wages and incomes, with these costs falling disproportionately on the least advantaged. So something that's interesting here is that if you're living in a world with a calibrated basic income, then it has no effect on incomes anymore, right? Because you're actually maxing out people's incomes. Eddie was talking about this feedback loop where people get incomes from jobs and then they're spending that money into the economy. So the demand for labor pays the labor, and then that stimulates demand for the rest of the economy, and it provides this feedback loop. That loop goes away in a basic income world. I mean, it's still there to the extent that people do get money from jobs and they spend that money, but ultimately people's incomes in aggregate are not going to be determined by wages. So that's an important thing to pay attention to. Comparing the two different worlds, I was kind of asking before, where is the labor demand coming from now in our economy? And where would that demand be coming from in a basic income world with perhaps an efficient labor market? In a basic income world, you're only going to have labor demand for the reason that we want the output of the labor. There are firms that are producing something and they want to sell that thing and they need to hire labor to produce that thing, whether that's goods or services. Neil was talking about the transition to services. Either way, the reason you have the labor is because of the output of the labor, because of the product of the labor. In today's economy, a lot of labor demand is not coming from the demand for the product of the labor. It's coming from, well, we're stimulating the financial sector to make it really easy for firms to borrow so that they hire people. So this labor demand is kind of coming from this artificial intervention by the government, whereas it wouldn't be in a basic income world. So I think that's something to pay attention to too. And obviously Jared Bernstein isn't talking about basic income in this article, but I think a lot of the mechanisms that he's paying attention to are very, very different in a basic income world. Go ahead, Eddie.
We're talking a little bit about kind of the purpose, you know, the kind of the purpose aspect of work, and I think a lot of thinking about that is fairly off. People who have sufficient wealth and sufficient passive income actually do have that problem. Like, if I don't have to spend all of my time making money so that I can survive, then what do I do with my time? But most people who don't have that problem would not consider that a problem. Like, if you offered them and said, you know, I'm going to give you X amount of passive income, but it's going to create a problem for you because, you know, right now you spend all your time working. And after you have that passive income, you're not going to have this work to do. So you're going to be really bored. I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, good Lord, no, I do not want that problem. I do not want to have that problem. Economically, you know, there's a lot of talk about make work in the basic income community. And I think that the mechanism for make work is not understood broadly enough. And in my opinion, the make work occurs if you look at labor as a market, and the supply of labor is very interesting in that, like Alex said, it's very inelastic. Most people have to work to live. So they're going to supply all of the labor onto the market. If you reduce the price of labor, if you reduce the wages that you're offering them, they are not going to do the classic economic supply curve thing and say, well, you're not paying me enough for my labor, I'm going to work less. And in fact, in many situations, it may actually run in the opposite direction. It may end up that because they're not making enough money per hour, they have to work more hours. They have to supply more hours because the price is down. And so if you played the devil and you wanted to create make work, reducing labor demand is really how make work actually occurs in the economy, because the price goes down, down, down. And as it goes down, the demand goes down. So the employers don't need the laborers as much. But as the employers, as the demand reduces, the supply cannot reduce. And so the price just keeps going down. And as the price eventually goes down enough that the employers say that it stimulates enough demand at a very low price, so that the employers are saying, well, you know, we don't really have much for anybody to do, but, you know, if people are working for just, you know, $10 an hour in a $20 trillion economy, then, okay, we'll find something for you to do. But it's, you know, it's not going to be a really great job. It's just, you know, something silly, but at least, you know, it's worth $10 an hour to the employer. You know, regarding the moving to the Fed and interest rates, I don't think that's a very effective way for the Fed to make employers hire people, because, you know, when interest rates go down and companies have a lot of access to money, we've seen what they do with it. They don't take all of that money and say, oh, you know, our job is to hire more people. No, they take all that money. They say our job is to maximize shareholder value, and we don't have anything to do with the money, so we'll use it to buy back our stocks. They'll just send the money straight to our shareholders. That's what we're going to do with it. Those are my thoughts for now.
I think those are some interesting thoughts. To kind of get to your last point, I think it's certainly true that easy money is not going to automatically make a business hire more people, but easy money does make more businesses viable. They can stay alive, and just by virtue of existing, there are people. It's a really inefficient way to create jobs or to push money to consumers, but it's what the Fed does. And all of the other things you said are true too. Companies are buying back stocks. You know, like, if in an ideal world we kind of wanted just jobs to be created and that to be the only effect. Well, we're very far from that ideal. I don't think that's a good ideal, but we're still very far from that ideal because of all these other things that monetary stimulus does. So what ends up happening is we end up pumping so much monetary stimulus into the financial sector that we get just enough job creation to prevent the price level from dropping. And then we get all these nasty side effects, including asset bubbles and the business cycle and all that kind of thing. So I think you're right in everything you're saying, but I think it's also what the Fed is trying to do and what the Fed thinks they're doing. They think they are lowering interest rates to bring up the level of employment or reduce the level of unemployment. And of course, Bernstein talks about that a lot in this article. And I think you're also right about the inelastic supply of labor because people need jobs or they die. So a reduced labor demand in terms of the amount of money that businesses are willing to pay for the labor hours that they hire, that can increase the amount of hours worked at that level. Of course, unless you get down to zero, because we can, of course, imagine leisure time as just labor that's being paid zero or volunteer time as labor that's being paid zero. I think some of the points that you're making, they kind of require that you divide between people's leisure time and their labor time. So at a particular time, this is when you're working. This is when you're performing work. This is when you're at your job. That counts as labor, whereas in the other time, it doesn't. Whereas if we imagine a more continuous pricing of people's time, then it can go all the way down to zero. And if there's a certain minimum that people need to survive, then as the price goes down and down and down, they have to work more and more and more to be able to buy the food they need, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what you're getting at, Eddie. Did you want to respond to that again?
Yeah, sure. I just want to say that, you know, conversely, you know, if you want to get rid of make work, the best way to do that, you know, through our understanding of economics is that you should actually stimulate more and more labor demand so that the price of labor goes way up so that nobody is going to take a $10 job, you know, flipping burgers, which Flippy can do much better and cheaper, when there's all these jobs that are paying like $30 an hour because there's so many other things in the economy that need doing that are more valuable, you know, just money-wise.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think it's useful to point out the distinction here is that when we're talking about labor demand, we're talking about both the price and the quantity of labor. So we're talking about a relationship between the price and the quantity. And obviously, if you just look at labor as everyone's time as one single thing, then the quantity is fixed. But as you go up in price, the amount that employers are willing to pay for those people's time decreases, right? But if you stimulate labor demand, so this is what Eddie is talking about, if you increase the price that firms are willing to pay for people's labor, then the number of hours, the quantity of hours that people want to supply at that price might decrease, even though the total number of quantity of hours in their lives is fixed, is always fixed. Let's go to Joan.
I'm going to go back a bit because I still have questions about the whole idea of the culture change, that I don't think it's trivial. I think that we're underestimating the force of conformity, not so much the force of, you know, some people can't figure out a purpose or this or that. There's actually a big drive for people to do the thing that other people are doing around them. And that includes, you know, a job. And that also includes consuming. So I think those two things work together in the kind of psychological sense. Not, you know, you're talking about the economic sense of that. But I think psychologically, if people are working, they also have a drive to consume, to spend their wages. When people are, and not just because they can afford it, but because that's part of what people are doing around them. And I think that cultural shift from not working so much maybe and not spending so much is not trivial. Maybe takes decades. I don't think it's, I mean, you're talking about it like it's, oh, it's just a shift.
Oh no, it's not trivial at all. It could take, you know, you could even imagine it takes thousands of years or something like that, right? But I think what Bethany was pointing out is that you have two problems. You have the question of what does the world look like before and after, and then what does it look like during the transition? That doesn't mean that the transition isn't a huge thing that may take a really, really long time and that we have to do things about. But I like what you say about people wanting to do what other people are doing around them. If you can imagine a world that's had basic income for thousands of years, then maybe the stuff that other people are doing around you, it doesn't look like our economy now. It doesn't look like, you know, getting a job and earning a living and that kind of thing.
Bethany and I talked about this, that, you know, the conformity aspect could come into play if there is basic income across the board. And then what other people are doing, you look to your left and your right and you see that other people are not, you know, working and are not working as much as they did. And so that becomes a norm. So yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. It takes a while.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if the norm becomes not to work, then maybe you have to pay people more to get them to work, right? To kind of overcome, like, oh, most people are not working. How do you pull someone away from their life of leisure? You might have to pay them more.
I was just going to kind of add on to this conversation and say that you already also see that people seek prestige in different ways. And one of them is paid work that gives you money, but it also gives you some status, right? But there are other ways that people seek status too. Like, not only do I work, but I have like a garden we were talking about last time, or I have like a cool way to brew my own beer, or I don't know, take photographs, or I help out and volunteer, whatever. So I could imagine that forms of like looking to other people and seeing what they're doing and seeing what's bringing them status could still be very similar, but just less of the time, perhaps it would be a paid job. Or maybe even there would be a recognition that being paid in a job, we even have a little bit of this now, like there's sort of like a trade-off maybe between focusing on something because it gives you money versus focusing on something because you have other reasons to do it, like personal interest or, you know, the contribution it makes or your own creative talents or something like that. So you could even see an extension of what we see now, which is like there can be extra prestige sometimes for not being paid. I think this is only true if you can be like somewhat financially secure, but like in terms of trading off maybe a higher salary for some other reason, like imagine like how we view investment bankers versus maybe like doctors or their artists paid off, but maybe like teachers or artists or something. There are people who might value the artist more in part because they forewent like a bigger salary to do something that was making a different kind of contribution. And same for teachers and stuff like this. This is even sold to like Teach for America as a program, for example, basically sells this kind of idea. You don't make a lot of money, but you're making a contribution. These are students who, people do it who could have made a lot more money. So you can imagine like these trade-offs being in play and like prestige coming from other things as it does now, but maybe even more so.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's a lot of incentives and there's a lot, culture is complicated, right? So we don't necessarily know how things are going to shake out. We don't necessarily know how the transition is going to go, but we have to be aware that there is going to be a transition. We just want to be prepared for that. What I was going to say before is that in addition to cultural norms around not working, obviously the obvious reason why people wouldn't work as much is because they don't need to, which is kind of what Eddie was getting at. So let's go to the next quote from the article. Two estimated variables are typically used as benchmarks for calculation of labor market slack. First, the so-called natural rate of unemployment, and second, potential GDP. These variables are not directly observed, but must be inferred from other data in the context of a particular economic model. So this is a really tricky thing. You know, assuming we even care about labor demand and increasing labor demand and decreasing, you know, labor market slack. The question is, how can we tell how far away we are? And the typical measures is that the Fed is looking at the level of unemployment and saying, well, a lot of people don't have jobs, therefore we can stimulate the economy and get those people hired and kind of get things going again. That's kind of the conventional view. And then there are also measures of how high is GDP compared to what we would expect it to be. So this is, you know, these are measures of the productive capacity of the economy, which also aren't really connected to the real world. It's you have kind of a model about and a theory about how all the different variables are connected and you make an estimate. And I think, you know, what we would find in a basic income world is that our actual economic output, our actual production would end up being a lot higher than our estimates of what our capacity is today. Let's go to Neil.
I have 2 points, if I can remember them. The first point is people do not like to move. They are in a particular area, and they know what's going on in that area. And we have a big problem, and basically that's part of the reason we have the particular social debate we're getting right now. People do not want to stop doing whatever they have been doing because they're used to it. And there are suggestions, hard to do, that the government should subsidize older workers who are stuck in where they are, and wind down whatever industry you're talking about. In other words, provide enough money so that it pays to continue that whatever you're talking about in the area where it is. But wind it down, because they're only going to subsidize older workers, and newer workers know it's going to die. And also the government should provide money so that people can move easier when they're young. People might move when they're young, but when they're older, it's unlikely. Then there's additional friction problems. I've lost my other point of view. But the world is a little complicated. If you provide a basic income, by the way, I was going to say, I have not been needed to work for maybe 20 years. I've saved enough salary. But of course, I kept working until they put a pistol to my head and they said, you're retired. You can't work. Okay, and then and my job now is singing. That is what I've taken up. Now, I hopefully am providing happiness to some people. And that's why I think I do. So, but that is now my avocation. And but just because I could stop working, I didn't want to. I couldn't work as much because I was older. As you get older, you're just harder to work as long.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I didn't want to work. As much as I could, I wanted to be with the people and continue doing what I was expertise at, because that's what I know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So a question we can ask is, to what extent do we want additional measures to help people move, to help people find things to do? And this is kind of what Joan brought up, to find things to do with their time if they're not working at their previous job anymore, if they're not living in their previous place anymore. And I think basic income on its own can help with some of that, but not all right. of that. Obviously, if you have a basic income, then that gives people more money, so they have the option of moving if they're younger or older, maybe more likely to move if they're younger. But it doesn't help with maybe some other things. Like, a lot of people just don't know what to do with their time. We want to provide exciting things for people. I think it creates a market, though, right? If you have all these people out there that have money to spend, now, if you're an entrepreneur, you have a lot of opportunities to sell things to people. You know, all of these people are bored at home with their money. What are you going to do? What products are you going to come up with? What activities are you going to come up with to try to sell them? Experiences and services and that kind of thing. So I think it creates a whole new market, but there's a little bit of a vacuum there as the market catches up with this demand. You can think of boredom as a form of demand. Bored people with money are sources of demand. So let's go to Eddie. Go ahead, Eddie.
So I love that we have this quote with the natural rate of unemployment, the non-accelerating inflationary rate of unemployment, as it's also called. So the natural, the non-accelerating inflationary rate of unemployment, it's a broken piece of economic thinking. You have unemployment on one hand, observable, and you have inflation on the other hand. And then you have a theoretical Phillips curve that relates the two to each other. But the problem is that the Phillips curve apparently changes unpredictably. So if it changes unpredictably, then this is basically like a fancy mathematical model that basically says we have no idea how these two things are related to each other, because we thought it was related with this curve, but then it didn't follow that curve. So obviously the curve changed. Basically economists are not admitting that they just don't know. So the basic mainstream economic thinking on controlling the economy, there's an analogy which I think is very apt, and I think that, you know, it's more apt than people think, that I think it completely describes really how the Fed basically thinks, which is that it's like a car, and you have an accelerator. And so when the economy is slowing down too much and you don't want it to slow down, then you hit the accelerator, you bring interest rates down by 5 percentage points, and the car speeds up again. And it's as if, you know, from the 80s until now, it's as if you started off with your foot completely off the accelerator and the car was going just fine. And then a recession hits, and so you hit the gas a little bit, and you know those car speeds up again, and you get through the recession. And then another recession hits, and you hit the gas again. But the thing is that each time you hit the gas, you never quite let your foot up quite, you know, the whole way. You keep your foot just keeps getting lower and lower, harder on the gas pedal. Each time recession hits, that's the interest rate going from 20% in the 80s, you know, and then every time recession hits, they jam it down. We get through the recession, but when it comes back, it never comes back up to how high it was before. And so you end up with the, you know, pedal going farther and farther down until now we're all the way at the floor. We're at 0% and we're hitting the bottom. And we entered the last recession at 2% with not enough room, not as much room as we usually need to get out of recession, and you're on, you know, what the economists call the zero limit bound, and it's quite hard to bring them down anymore. And so if you imagine yourself in this scenario, what you should be thinking is, how come, you know, I keep having to hit the gas harder and harder every time I hit a recession? You know, if I understood this correctly, if that was the correct understanding of causality, you know, it should be something where just, you know, recession, gas, and it always works. But obviously it just keeps working less and less and less. And so the reason that happens, I'm arguing, is because of the paradox of the worker consumer and the paradox of productivity growth, where, you know, the income of the worker consumer is getting bled away towards the income of capital, which is paradoxical, because then they don't have money to spend, which then the economy has no point in producing anything if people don't have money to buy it, which, you know, feeds back into, you know, why do we need basic income?
I like what you said about the Phillips curve and something interesting about it. So the Phillips curve is basically this idea that as unemployment goes down, that causes wages to go up and causes inflation. So the lower the unemployment is, the higher the inflation is. And as Eddie was pointing out, this relationship is kind of loose, and it changes. It's hard to predict. It's not something you can measure directly. But even more than that, even theoretically, it goes away completely in a basic income world. Right? You don't, if it depends on people's incomes coming from jobs, coming from wages. And if you disconnect those two things, then the Phillips curve becomes meaningless, because the way people get their income is no longer tied to the level of unemployment or something like that anymore. So basic income, essentially, Eddie is talking about worker consumers and the paradox of the worker consumer. Basic income decouples the role of worker from the role of consumer in the economy. So then you can ask, does it even make sense to think of workers and consumers as being kind of the same people or the same units in the economy? And I think the answer is no. And I think, you know, it's hard to understand the effects of basic income if you're still thinking of consumers and workers as being like two sides of the same role. Let's go to Bethany.
I just had a few points related to what people said. So back to the question of like people knowing what to do or not, I guess retirement is an interesting example where people at least at a certain phase, expect to stop doing their normal job and maybe struggle to figure out what to do, or maybe don't struggle. It kind of depends on, I don't know all the data on that, but certainly there's a variation. I also like what Neil was saying, or I thought it was interesting what Neil was saying about people proposing kind of keeping jobs around for the sake of the people in them, but kind of phasing them out for younger workers. I guess a sort of pretty heavy-handed version of how to manage a transition to a basic income would be to kind of keep jobs going artificially by age, but like not renew them for younger people. This is maybe, I don't know if this is my favorite solution because it would take up people's time and like resources and stuff and maybe be a bit wasteful, but you theoretically could do that. You could just sort of like keep those jobs limping along or like going for the people who've been in them for a certain amount of time. And then the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, this is more about labor supply, I guess, than demand. But if people find that they really want to have the structure of going in to a traditional kind of paying job, I would assume that would perhaps mean that they don't have to be paid as much to do it, given that they're getting a basic income, and might on average increase the amount of basic income we could give people. So one of the like open variables that we talk about is we don't really know if people, how incentivized people will be to do things if they have a basic income. Like, will a small amount of basic income mean that everyone wants to stay home and do nothing, right? for work, or at least for paid work? And if that's the case, maybe the amount of basic income is lower than if people really want to go out and have a paid job. So I just want to tie that into the discussion we were having, that if the world we're in is one where people actually really get a lot of value out of the paid job outside of the money itself, it might increase the amount of basic income we can give people by decreasing like the average wage.
Yeah, if you don't care how much you're being paid and you just need a job, then you can get paid a lot less at your job. I think that's an important point. And that ties into labor demand, because we can ask, you know, how important is labor demand, or how is labor demand relevant or affected in a world with basic income? You know, kind of an open question for this discussion is, if in a basic income world, is labor demand going to be higher or lower than it is in our current world? And I think, I don't know the answer to that. My intuition is that if kind of like I was talking about at the beginning, if we think of people's time as fixed, there's a fixed quantity of it, and then there's an average price that we pay for people's time, my intuition is that the amount of money going toward labor in aggregate would be lower in a basic income world, because we're no longer creating labor demand through kind of these make work policies, or these economic policies that are designed to create jobs, which is kind of what the whole article is about. He's like, well, how do we use government to create more jobs and, you know, full employment fund and stuff like that? In a basic income world, we don't need any of that. And we're already doing lots of that, not specifically the things he's talking about in the article, but we're already doing lots of that, and we won't have to anymore. So my sense is that labor demand, in the sense of the total amount of money that's being paid to labor in the economy, would decrease in a basic income world, because we'd be filling in that gap with the basic income. The total incomes that people would have might rise, but the income from labor would probably decrease. But there's arguments to be made that it wouldn't. There's arguments to be made, and I think Eddie falls into this camp, that the committing to calibrating the basic income to activate the full economy will increase the size of the economy so much that people's income from the basic income will increase, but also their income from just an efficient labor market operating normally will increase a lot too, just because there's so much more demand for consumer goods and we can make use of that labor to produce more for people. I tend to be of the view that an efficient labor market is a lot less labor intensive. So even if we're able to produce a lot more, it wouldn't necessarily employ that much more labor. So let's go to another quote from the article. This fact of persistent slack, labor slack, might not be viewed as remarkable by many Americans stuck in places where gainful employment opportunities have long been elusive. But for economists relying on models that assume full employment, as many models do, the fact that the US economy has been at full employment less than a third of the time since 1980 is an awfully inconvenient truth. So I would say that, yes, a lot of economic models do assume that there's full employment, and most of the rest of the economic models assume that full employment is the ideal, that you want the economy to be at full employment, and that if it's below full employment, then you kind of want to figure out how to bring it there. And I think that's a problem too. I say this all the time, but if we're creating jobs as a way of pushing money to workers, then we're not using people's time efficiently. Let's go to Neil.
I just wanted to say that I disagree with Eddie. The Federal Reserve realizes what he's talking about, and they have, and the explanation, my explanation and some other people, is that we have a globalization situation, and you can produce goods everywhere in the world, and they basically, we've gotten into the trap, which we've all been talking about, for goods, where you can produce the goods cheaper than you can produce more goods than we really need. So basically, we keep trying to find ways for people to make those goods, but if it should really has to, the goods have to keep getting cheaper in a sense, in order for anybody to buy them, then we're pushing it on a string. We're not doing it. The Federal Reserve realizes this. However, they have no other solution. However, there is one thing which I think, which is now very much argued about. I say that if you have an economy where the government is borrows in its own currency and can do that, and you could basically just create money, whether basic income or anything else, and basically the Federal Reserve can buy up all the bonds, of basically where they're just printing the money and helicopter money out, and it's not clear that would hurt anything. It's not even clear. Japan has been trying to do that, trying to get out of the liquidity trap for 20 years, and they haven't been able to do it. So one way of putting out helicopter money is basic income. And that to me sounds much more reasonable, because now it doesn't matter that these older population really don't want to do status things. They don't really, maybe they want to take some people want to take trips. I mean, but more many people want to just stay with where they are and talk to the people they've been talking to forever. And so you could basically just provide a basic income, and until finally you would get into an inflationary problem, you could just keep printing money. And that you could get out of the trap which we are now in, where too low interest rates are not good. They're not good because you don't allocate your resources correctly. The interest rate should be higher than the inflation rate, so that firms which are non-productive go out of business. There are a lot of inefficiencies when you're, and the Federal Reserve knows this. That's where I disagree with Eddie. The Federal Reserve knows perfectly well that they have a problem. They just don't know the solution.
They certainly know they have a problem. They don't necessarily know the solution. A lot of times the Fed officials call for fiscal support. So they want the fiscal side to do more stimulus. They want the government to spend more so they can tighten their monetary policy, that kind of thing. So they do at least have an intuition there that something is not really within their realm of control that's forcing them into this position. And I think that's right. Unless the Fed does something really unorthodox, like helicopter money or doing the equivalent of deficit spending itself, their hands are pretty much tied. They can do what they do to keep prices stable, but they can't, you know, close the output gap. They can't, prevent necessarily asset bubbles and stuff like that. I liked what you said about keep printing money until you see inflation. And I think that intuition is basically right. I would probably add to that to say that there's a level of money printing that is not inflationary. There's a certain flow of money that is going to keep the economy going at current prices. And if you increase that flow, that's going to correspond to a higher price level where that flow is optimal. And this is kind of the natural rate of basic income, right? If you commit to increasing that flow of money forever, then you're going to keep having inflation as the flow increases and increases. But it's not like you just add a certain amount of money to the economy and then you're done. It's what's the right amount of money to always be adding to the economy. So it's the first derivative, right? It's what's the flow of money going into the economy, and also what's the distribution of that flow. Let's go to Eddie.
Alex was mentioning the question of whether labor income under a UBI will be higher or lower than without a UBI. And I think that the correct answer is that it depends. You know, you can think of society as kind of the aggregate consumer worker. You know, you can think of it as the, you know, the household analogy, as if the entire economy, everybody was one big household. And we have capital, so we have you know, machinery that's working for us. And we also, you know, input labor. We also, you know, do some work. You know, right now it's all broken, so we're not using the machinery correctly. The machinery is like sitting there idle. But, you know, let's assume that we put the basic income in, the machinery all go, the machines, the capital, you know, we start using those fully. There will be a choice at this point, there's a choice between, do we want to increase the material, status of the household? Do we want to build a bigger house? Do we want to, you know, it's already quite big, but do we want it even bigger? Do we want more material things? Or do we want to say, you know what, let's take a break, you know, now that the machines produce everything that we need, you know, let's take a day off and go to the beach. There is on an aggregate level, the level of labor income will depend, even with UBI, on how much we spend. So spending is us, you know, the household saying we want more stuff. Well, if we want more stuff, then we will have to do more work to make that stuff. So I think that is the answer, that it will depend. And I think that we're in a situation right now that the immediate effect will be a massive increase in labor income going down to the, you know, lower income levels of society that don't have enough right now. But, you know, as we move forward into post-scarcity, really, I think at some point everybody will say, you know what, you know, $60,000 worth of, you know, $100,000 worth of goods and services, plenty. You know, I think I'll just live on that amount and I'll spend, you know, 80% of my time, going on missions like Star Trek or something.
Yeah, and to tie it back to last week's discussion, it's also going to depend on what kinds of resources we want to conserve. Like maybe we have this hypothetical scenario where the basic income just supercharges the economy. There's a lot more investment, a lot more production, but you're using up a lot more resources, that kind of thing. And then in that scenario, maybe one of those resources you're using up a lot of is labor, and income from labor increases, for example. But if you put in measures to conserve resources, so if you're taxing all the various inputs to production that you want to save for later, then maybe what you might end up seeing is that because of that, the total labor income goes down. Like we might, if we're looking to introduce a basic income, we might think, okay, our economy produces roughly the right amount of stuff today. We just want to make sure everyone has access and it gets distributed to everyone. We don't want to burn out our available resources. So then if you're doing that, then the primary mechanism you'll see is a shift between labor demand that comes from kind of make work to push money to consumers to just giving people money directly through the basic income. So you'd see kind of a net reduction in labor utilization and a reduction in incomes coming from wages. Let's go to the article, Jared Bernstein again. Weak aggregate demand, the total demand for goods and services throughout the economy, is an especially pervasive problem with unique characteristics. By definition, it suggests resource underutilization, which implies some degree of market failure, thus warranting a policy response. Similar to falling unionization, weak demand erodes the ability of many in the workforce to bargain for higher compensation. Even in the absence of unions, strong demand leads employers to bid up their wage offers to get and keep the workers they need if they are to meet consumer demand. In slack labor markets, such wage pressures abate. So basically he's saying that regardless of what we're doing on the supply side, controlling the supply of labor with unions and negotiation and stuff like that, if you have strong labor demand, then that on its own can pull wages up. But I think this is not the case if you're talking about the mechanism that Eddie was describing before, where the reason labor in terms of number of hours demanded goes up is because you're lowering the price because the labor supply has gone down or something like that. So you could see this phenomenon of more employment at lower wages, which you might think as you might frame as higher labor demand, but it's not the kind of higher labor demand that he's talking about here. So I want to call attention to the implied connection between the demand for goods and services and the demand for labor. Because I think in a basic income world, in a calibrated basic income world, there is that connection. Labor demand is more of a translation of consumer demand and also real capital investment, right? If the labor market is efficient, then that's what's happening in the basic income world. In our world, labor demand is not really that well connected to what's actually happening in the real economy, what's actually happening with consumer demand, right? So even if you boost consumer demand in today's world, that won't necessarily translate to more jobs. If you boost money going to businesses so they can, or it does very inefficiently, right? Just the connection between aggregate demand, so consumer demand, and labor demand. I think there are a lot of assumptions that economists make about what would happen in an efficient economy that would be true in a world with basic income that aren't true now because we use so much economic policy to intervene with the markets. So let's go to this next quote. As expected, increases in employment led to increases in wages, and increases in the unemployment rate led to decreases in wages. Notably, the impact was much larger on low-wage workers. And in fact, for high-wage workers, slack and wages appear to be unrelated. So this is an interesting point. If labor demand is weak, it tends to affect low-wage jobs more than high-wage jobs. And another question we can ask is, does any of this matter? Do we care about what wages are? In today's world, of course, it's how people get their money, but in a basic income world, again, it is not. He's kind of exploring or examining the problem within the current framework. People get their money from jobs. Go ahead, Eddie.
Just to follow up on what Alex was saying, you know, as we move into the UBI economy, you know, one of the ways, and to follow up on the household analogy, one of the ways to think about that is that as we increase the UBI and we get it high enough so that everything that people need, everything that people spend on is mostly created using capital and only a little bit is created using demand, you know, what's happening is that the income in society is shifting away from labor income into capital income, that we're using the machines. And so it's really this is actually another perspective. This is another way to look at what UBI is it's actually universal capital income. It is the claim tickets distributed to everybody so that we can put the machines to work, which is missing in the current economy. And so it's also a very interesting thing because I think in the progressive movement, there was some backlash during the Yang campaign, and then now some of them are for it and some of them are, you know, there's a little bit of a controversy going on now. But I think UBI is very interesting because if you are like a Marxist and you think people, we should all have benefits from the means of production, UBI is the way to have everybody benefit and even effectively own the means of production because you have the right to access the production of those means.
Yeah, I like what you say about shifting labor income to capital income. Basically, we own the machines and our basic income is what gives us our share of access to the machines we own or the capital we own in the economy. And I think that is the right way of thinking about it. It is a form of ownership, and any money you get from anywhere kind of represents a claim on the economy. So it does represent a form of ownership of our collective productive capacity. So I think that's always true. And the key thing about basic income is that now it's not tied to labor anymore. And in a basic income world, in a calibrated basic income world, as the basic income increases, you'll see that shift kind of from labor to capital. In today's world, one might argue that the income, a lot of the income that people are getting from jobs is already this capital income that we're just funneling to them through this kind of back channel, like getting it in the back door, pretending that you're still contributing, still putting labor into the system, that kind of thing. But you're really just being handed the money to give you access to what the economy can provide for you. Let's go to Neil. Go ahead, Neil.
I would just like to point out that all these wonderful theories just don't account for the fact of the stickiness of people to wherever they are. You cannot lower the unemployment rate not because of this of your curve, but because people will not move. They really will not move. That is why you can have pockets of extreme poverty in an area, and people won't move because the fear of going to somewhere where they know nobody is more than the fear, unless until they get to starvation. More than the fear that they have very low income from where they are, and we all these wonderful theories don't account for that, and that is really what to me puts a floor in the present system and what unemployment can be. You have to have a certain amount. You will never get zero income because you never get real full employment because they have these areas where there's no reason for businesses to open up because there's nothing there, and there's no reason for people to move because they're frightened that if they move they're all left without a lifeline. So I think that most economists don't put that in their models, and that changes things a lot if you realize that.
I think what they do is they just account for the fact that there is kind of a natural rate of unemployment that you can't go below. So the economists are not thinking that you can get everyone a job who wants one at a certain rate. They think you can go so far and then it kind of stops. So in terms of why it stops, I think the stickiness, people not wanting to move, that's part of it, right? So that's kind of where it goes into the model. But I don't think they're ignoring that. I think they're just kind of factoring it in this way of saying, oh, there's a natural rate of unemployment. And that can include frictional unemployment, like people are between jobs. It can also include people don't want to move, that kind of thing. It's also worth asking the question, why this is a useful goal. And I guess we all here think it's not necessarily a useful goal to try to boost labor demand or achieve full employment or something like that. We did a whole one of these on full employment. We also did a whole one of these on the housing market and how basic income affects people's incentive to move. So even if people are stuck living where they live and they would be better off somewhere else, it would be nice if they'd be able to move. Even if we don't care about getting them a job or getting them employed, reducing unemployment, it's still nice if people have that flexibility. So I think basic income can help with that. Let's go back to Jared Bernstein. Given the real hourly wage stagnation for low and middle wage men in the 1980s and both men and women in the 2000s, to the extent that incomes rose during those periods, those increased incomes were largely a result of more work rather than higher wages. Hourly wage stagnation, in other words, far from costless. But the record also shows that strong labor demand raises incomes through increases in both employment and hours worked. And let's go to Eddie.
Responding to Neil a little bit, I'm glad he brought that up because Alex talked about it also. I think it's very important to distinguish between frictional unemployment and structural unemployment. And so in addition to the location problem, you also have a temporal problem in time with frictional unemployment. And I would argue that recessions are essentially frictional unemployment. So Recessions, do work through the paradox of thrift, and, for like half a year, everybody's, scared, everybody's pulling back. And so for the moment, there's no jobs. But I would argue that, even if you did nothing about those recessions, people get scared for a while, but eventually their spirits come back up. And that would actually resolve itself. But there is a different problem that is there at the same time, a structural problem. And I would argue that Keynes actually mistook the structural problem for a frictional problem. He mistook the paradox of the worker consumer for a paradox of thrift. And so, I would argue that what causes the depression during the Great Depression, the 1940s and currently, which is structural, again, is the distribution of income in society, which is not affected by people's moods. Like, everybody can be very brave today, but the people who have low incomes working, they still have low incomes, and so they're still not going to be able to consume, which will feed back into businesses not being able to stay busy, which will feed back into more unemployment, lower demand, labor demand, lower wages.
Well, I think the idea is that if everybody's brave, then businesses will hire more people, right?
Yeah, that's the idea of paradox of thrift. But the problem is that no matter how brave you are, being brave doesn't change the income distribution. And so if everybody's brave and we go and vote for universal basic income and we get income to the people at the bottom of the distribution who need it, then that fixes the problem. But trying to fix it just by being brave within the system, it doesn't work, because if businesses are brave right now, what they'll do is they'll say, wow, interest rates are very low. Let's buy some more machines. That Flippy burger, that Flippy thing, that's going to be really profitable. Let's buy a million of those. They'll spend a great deal of money. There will be, certain amount of work to be done to build those Flippy burgers. And then after that, the problem is even worse.
So you're just saying the effect is really weak because a lot of this stuff is not very labor intensive. And then once you're done, whatever jobs you happen to create disappeared because you've made the investment. And meanwhile, people are stuck with not very much money.
Right. I'm saying the fundamental problem is the imbalance of capital in society and consumption in society. And that lowering the interest rates and building more capital kind of temporarily fixes it, because people get work building the capital. But now that we have even more capital, it actually in the long run exacerbates it, because you have even more capital and even more underutilization in the economy. And that capital, like Flippy, will actually take away even more jobs, even more labor demand.
Yeah, some more capacity that's not being used.
Yeah, so the only way to fix it is to send it straight. You have to send it to the consumption side of the divide, which the current Federal Reserve monetary policy fails to do.
Right. And to the extent that it does so temporarily because the jobs are created as part of the capital investment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get back to the article, Jared Bernstein. One way to ensure that the Federal Reserve uses policy in a way to maintain sufficient aggregate demand while addressing a number of changing macroeconomic realities and growing risks, particularly zero lower bound risk, is for the Fed to raise its inflation target. Better yet, the Fed should shift to targeting the level of a key variable like the price index, nominal GDP, or the nation's wage bill. While any such changes would be large and potentially disruptive, they could be helpful in more reliably sustaining aggregate demand. So I think all of these measures are not going to solve the problem that he's trying to solve. So the idea with increasing the inflation target is that, okay, now we're living in our current world, but what if we were living in a world where inflation were a lot higher. That would allow us to keep interest rates higher and let us lower interest rates if we really needed to, if inflation fell below the target or something like that. But it doesn't seem to really add up to me. And I think the problem, again, is that you're trying to boost aggregate demand and you're trying to boost labor demand, and you're not recognizing that what matters is the access that consumers have to the output of the economy, rather than trying to like get the economy going and then that benefits people in some other way. Or there is a direct way in which getting the economy going benefits people. It's that I spend money to buy something. So I'm offering to spend money, that activates something in the economy, and then I get the thing. It's not this roundabout thing where I spend money and then it creates jobs. That's never going to be a sustainable way to run an economy. And for me, I'm always averse to the idea that we should have higher inflation. The idea that we should have a price level target instead of an inflation target. One of the problems you run into there is that now if the economy's inflation is running behind for a while, then you have to play catch up and then you have a lot of inflation. So you have very little inflation and then a lot of inflation. And if people are trying to plan in the economy, then that makes it difficult for people to plan using a stable pricing standard, you know, having stable expectations into the future. So my sense is that if inflation is too low for a while, then you want to get inflation back to where it is, or you want to get it back to zero if zero is your target, or 2% if 2% is your target. But you don't want to like overshoot and then get back to the price level, back to where it would have been if you'd been on target the whole time. That feels like something that could destabilize things further. And I want to point out the nominal GDP target in particular. What you're doing is you're trying to keep the overall level of output in the economy in money terms at a certain level or a certain increasing trajectory. And if you're doing that, then you've completely lost the anchor between the value of money and what it can buy, or between the prices and how much stuff you're actually getting for that price. So right now we anchor our money, we make it so that our money can buy a certain amount of stuff in the economy. If all you're doing is targeting the amount of money that's spent in the economy, it's not connected to the real economy anymore. So I think a nominal GDP level target would be an especially egregious mistake, but a price level target would similarly be not as good as just an inflation target. The price level target, at least you're connecting the price level to the prices of the real economy, which you wouldn't be doing in the nominal GDP target. So that was kind of a mouthful, but I had a lot to say about that quote. Let's go to Neil.
I have two comments. The first comment is the Federal Reserve has now come to the conclusion that if you have a target for your inflation rate, but you never reach it, people will not believe that the target is a target. And people behave the way they think things are, not the way you say they are. And so the Federal Reserve has changed its policy, and they have said that we will allow marginal amounts higher than our 2% for a reasonable amount of time so that we can approximately average 2%. So they've compromised. They said we cannot do what you're talking about. You cannot just stick at an inflation rate, because if we don't get there all the time ever, then people won't believe us. Yet if we take any other target, we get into the problems you were talking about. So they have attempted to get a good optimum answer. And let's see, the other thing. Oh, you keep Eddie keeps thinking that in terms of capital goods, and I keep saying that we shouldn't worry about capital goods in this economy. We should worry about services. And I could hire an awful lot of teachers. I could hire an awful lot of cops. I could hire an awful lot of social workers. I could, and then they all, you could say they're all doing reasonably good things, but they're not producing anything. And I could hire, I could set up cruise ships, and then people work on the cruise ships. So an awful lot of this economy is now services. And the problems that Eddie's talking about do exist in a lot of economies, but not in our particular one at the present time. So those are my two points.
Yeah, so a question we might ask is, or I will ask you directly, why would we want to hire a lot of these various services? Why would we want these cruise ships and teachers and police officers? Why would we want it more than say we have now or something like that?
Because we don't have an optimum number. Basically, the elasticity of cruise ships is pretty high if people have money, and the elasticity for more police. Well, if you have enough police, then you can train them better. We could get out of all the problems we now have. And if you don't want police, you can have social workers. So, anyways, in a sense, I agree with the conservatives in the sense that you can have runaway government. But I disagree with the conservatives in the sense that all government is bad. The point is, I hope that we end up with two political parties so that when we get carried away in one direction, we get back to the other. But I'm sorry that now we don't have two parties like that. So in my view, worrying about capital goods in our particular United States is not necessarily what you should worry about. We could plant a lot of trees. There are so many things we could do which would be obviously useful. So what's the problem?
Yeah, so I think you're right that there are a lot of things we could do, a lot of services we could provide that would be obviously useful. So then it's just a matter of the opportunity cost. Do we want to pull people away from what they would otherwise be doing to perform those services? I guess kind of what I was getting at is that there's this distinction between creating labor demand. So like using services to create labor demand versus the idea that we need or would benefit from a lot more services. And that kind of generates labor demand on its own. So labor demand isn't kind of the end goal. It's that we have these services we want. And I think that's what you're getting at, that there's things we want to pay people to do and we should pay them to do that. And that's fine. But the benefit of that isn't that now you've employed people. The benefit of that is that you get the product of the labor. You get that service being performed. You know, the fact that you're using up people's time, right? That's a cost, not a benefit. That's not a benefit of employing all these people. Let's go to Eddie. Go ahead, Eddie.
So to respond a little bit to Neil's points, I think that the goods services divide is actually, it doesn't impinge on the dynamic I'm talking about, because even services are susceptible to productivity growth. So, you know, we've recently bought a Roomba, and, you know, whereas previously there was a service going on here where somebody, you know, it might be like unpaid in the household, but somebody is performing the service of, dusting up. I can imagine in 5 to 10 years that, we'll be able to build a robot barber, and there'll be a Roomba, brand robot barber at the household that cuts your hair for you every month. And vacuums up the clippings. Nice. Yeah. the Flippy that we're talking about, you know, some people, you could consider that a good because it's a hamburger, but you could also consider it a service, which is where the restaurant industry is often placed because people are cooking your food as a service to you. So there's, or a policeman, if many of those police are, sitting on the highway, checking how fast people are going, and you replace that, you know, as they have in many countries with a speed trap, you've just, automated away a service police job. And so to me, the services, that it still has the same dynamic where you end up replacing labor with capital, but you need to replace the income that the consumer worker was getting. Otherwise, the capital just sits there, unused, and you also get unemployment. And low wages.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are a lot of things we need or that we would benefit from paying people to do that we're not doing right now. And that falls into the category of goods, services, and capital. And we'd be able to activate all of that stuff if we have a basic income. I want to get to the article again. Here we go. Unlike many of the factors that dampen wage levels and growth, including eroded labor standards, arguments in favor of strong aggregate demand do not tend to provoke partisan rancor. In principle, policymakers generally agree on the need for strong demand. So I picked this one because I very much disagree that it makes sense to have demand be a goal in itself. And that's either consumer demand or labor demand, right? Consumer demand, if everybody has money, is a reflection of the fact that people want to buy things. If they don't want to buy things, that's fine too. And similarly for labor demand, if we don't need to hire as many people, that's great. Maybe we can give people more leisure time. Maybe we're getting less and less labor intensive and we can let the capital do more and more of our work. I think all of that is great. And basic income lets us do that. If we're focused on this cycle of people get their income through wages and stimulating the economy through demand, then we kind of miss that. Let's go to Neil. Go ahead, Neil.
I just wish, I don't think Eddie completely understands what I'm saying. I agree that possibly in the far future, we will have used up all the services that we could want. But you still would have singers. You still would have artists. It just doesn't seem to me that services has the same limit that capital does. You could only want a certain number of cars. You could only want, hopefully we can build more buildings. You could only want whatever. But services, people helping other people, we could, my God, you go to a restaurant, one of the reasons you go there is you get service. If you have it completely automated, they've tried it. Automats work because they're cheaper, but basically people would rather have the waiter come around, and you know, and so basically I think it's pretty, services are pretty elastic, whereas capital isn't. So I disagree with Eddie that even though I agree that particular service jobs will be automated out of existence, this doesn't mean that. That services cannot be there. Of course, there's friction. So you know, while you're changing from one service to another service, we will have problems. But I don't see services as, I see services nearly infinite because we could pay people just to talk to each other.
Yeah, I think that's right. No matter what future we imagine, people will always have reasons to pay each other to do things, whether it comes in the form of services. A lot of it might, but it could also come in the form of stuff related to goods or capital as well. And I think Eddie agrees with you too, that there's no limit. He says in the chat, there's no limit to how many services can be provided, but the consumer still needs money in their hands to pay for the services. So I think all of that is right. And I would just emphasize that there is an opportunity cost. If you're paying someone to do something, or if you're withholding enough basic income from people to create an incentive for them to perform services at a certain wage, then you're paying that opportunity cost of what they would spend that time doing otherwise. So maybe there are services that would be nice to have if we could get them for free, but they're not worth the cost of employing people, for example. So let's go to the article one more time. Given that the most recent few economic expansions fell victim to imploding asset bubbles, the Federal Reserve's macroprudential role, its oversight of the banking system, is also germane to this agenda. The key policy recommendation is to use regulatory and not interest rate policy to push back on potential bubbles and underpriced risk. That is, if financial markets become too effervescent, it is important to employ regulatory interventions, for example, rules that reduce leverage ratios, rather than interest rate hikes as countervailing measures. So I think you can try to use regulations to restrict some of this stuff, but the reality is that a lot of the banking in our economy, a lot of the financial activity is not happening through institutions that typically fall under regulations. Most of the banking isn't done by banks. And then we can try to regulate these other institutions, but ultimately borrowing is about promising, right? It's about people making agreements with each other, or businesses, institutions, financial institutions, or otherwise making agreements with each other. And if you regulate one specific thing, people will make those agreements in some other way. So I think there is a role for regulating the financial sector, but I'm skeptical of the idea that this could be our main tool for preventing asset bubbles. I think if you have a basic income and you allow yourself to raise interest rates a lot, you don't have this problem where the high interest rates cause people to lose their incomes, because the basic income is giving people their incomes, but you do get the benefit of the high interest rates reining in lending activity in the financial sector. Go ahead, Eddie.
I used to think it was reasonable, the Austrian view, that, or the view of some Austrians, that the Federal Reserve is basically, blowing up an artificial bubble, and this is not good. Since coming to capital consumption theory, I've changed my mind about that, and I now think that the entire situation, including the asset bubbles and the asset price inflation, again, is actually a symptom of capital consumption imbalance. And if you look at the Fed, the Federal Reserve, and the government as a whole, if you add those things, two things together, the Federal Reserve is expanding the monetary base. They're pumping money into the financial sector, but the government as a whole, through government borrowing, is actually taking about 10 times that amount out of the financial sector by borrowing the money and using it for government spending. And so, it's clear that what they call the savings glut, the glut of financial capital that's, running around the world with nothing to do, and that's what drives down all the interest rates and the discount rates, and drives all the valuations up, that would exist even if you took the government out of the picture and you had no Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I think that's right. If the government is borrowing, then if anything, that drives interest rates up because they're selling treasuries onto the market, and that drives up some kind of risk-free yields, right? So yeah. That makes borrowing more expensive in the private sector. I think that's exactly right. So we are getting to the end here. I want to go around the room, get people's final thoughts on labor demand and its relevance to basic income. Go ahead, Eddie.
I'm working on an article around this topic this week. So, check out my article when it's ready. It will be on Medium, and I'll send it out on Twitter, @EddieChu888.
Okay, fantastic. Eddie Chu, CHU888 on Medium. Let's go to Neil, Richard, and then Bethany.
As I've been saying all along, basically my view is there is no limit to the amount of jobs we could use, which would be useful, and so therefore you could provide a basic income, except for friction. In other words, the jobs have to occur, except for friction. You could just keep going. So if you had a basic income, you just have to worry about the friction. And as I pointed, some of the friction is people don't want to move and the other frictions. But that's my view. The basic income could work in this society. Now, I don't know if at the present time, what happens in the future, who knows?
So I want to push back for a second, because you've brought up again and again the fact that we're not going to run out of useful jobs. But I brought up the fact that, useful compared to what? Useful compared to how people would otherwise spend their time. I think there's a limit to how far you want to go there, right?
No, I don't think so. I am not paid right now, but I am a singer. Mm-hmm. And a very good singer. Just accidentally, I have a good voice. Now, somebody else might be like to paint. So, okay, we could pay for painting. They did that in the Great Depression. And I just don't see people will invent what they want to do, whether it's being a mentor to older people who have mental problems. There's so many things. I don't see the limit you do. That's the only difference.
Well, I certainly agree that people will invent what they want to do, and they'll naturally spend their time in ways they want to spend their time. The question is, to what extent do we want to withhold basic income from people to provide an incentive for them to spend their time doing something else in order to earn the money back? And I think there's a limit to that.
I don't know. Because I basically think people feel productive in very different ways.
So you would be interested in keeping the basic income lower to provide an incentive for people to
don't know if you
do
need
things.
It. I have no idea, but I know that people like to do things. They want to socialize.
Now, sure.
And basically, there are some jobs which are just so bad that maybe you if you made the basic income so high, it wouldn't work. But there are very few. But there are an awful lot of people who like to do all sorts of strange things. So I'm not as worried as you are.
The issue is that if you're paying people, you're pulling them away from what they actually want to do, right?
No, not necessarily. I don't see it. I got paid for many, many years for doing what I love to do.
If you weren't paid, would you have done it?
If I could live without it, sure.
Okay, there you go. So then it's not a job anymore.
It was always a hobby, in your point of view.
Yeah. The labor market is for when we need to pay people to do something else with their time, something other than what they would ordinarily do.
That is a fact, and that is the reason why we have different wages for different jobs. Yeah. Sure. But that's a limit on how much basic income can be. But I think it's much less of a problem than you do. I think that there are a lot of people who want to be cops. There are a lot of people who want to be teachers. There are a lot of people who want to plant trees. There are a lot of people who want to farm. They just like to do it.
Okay, that's great. That means we don't need to pay them, right?
In a sense, if they had enough money, you don't need to pay them.
Yeah, all right.
We agree, but we do. So, okay. So I got paid for what I love to do, and I had to get paid. But so what? Not everybody's paid for what they love to do, but hopefully we'll have a better match if we have a basic income and jobs have got to be made more attractive in order for people to do them. So I don't think that is as a big problem. I just don't see it.
I'm not sure what you're describing as a problem.
I don't know. You've described a problem. You say that people won't work because they have a basic income. And all the studies I've seen, that's not true.
I don't think that's what I said.
Well, that's what I take it you say.
Okay. Go ahead, Richard.
People need to be open to living without jobs. Some people need to have some sort of status. Well, they can have it through gaming. Like, I want to be the highest person on the board, or they can find a second life, like the gaming system Second Life, where they can actually create their own life, idealized life in another gaming world, or they can invent a holodeck like in Star Trek, so they can actually create tables or weapons and things out of light. They just need to have the opportunity to do these things, and with basic income, they could have the opportunity to do these things.
Yeah, I like that. Maybe you could even say that basic income increases the demand for zero wage labor or leisure. Let's go to Bethany.
Yeah, so I guess just two things. One, I guess I still don't know for sure the answer to your question about whether basic income would increase or decrease demand for labor. I tend to be with you, but I guess it's just something that we'll have to find out. Do with you that it might decrease it, but it's something we have to find out. And then the other thing was just to speak to, again, what you and Neil were talking about. I think that goes back to what I was saying before, which is like the more people want to do stuff anyway, given that they have like some foundation of money, if they don't need to be paid extra to do an activity, then they can, those activities will get done anyway. So let's say that if we need a lot of teachers and people are willing to teach for free or for very little money, I think that just frees up more money to give to people in a basic income. Otherwise we might need to pay people to get them to do that work because we need that work, and then the basic income might be smaller. So I feel like you and Neil are kind of on the same, maybe a bit more on the same page than you realize, but that's how I would tie it together. And I think I said that earlier, but just bringing it back.
Okay, good. Thanks, Bethany. So as to the question of whether basic income will cause an increase or decrease in labor demand, I think Bethany is right that we don't know the answer. I think it depends on a lot of things. But I think even more importantly than that, it doesn't matter, right? What matters is that when you're getting money to people through basic income, you're not creating jobs, you're not creating labor demand as a way of getting money to consumers, then the labor demand that you have left in your economy is the right kind of labor demand. It's labor demand that's productive and efficient. We're using labor efficiently. So labor demand is maybe higher, it's maybe lower, but what matters is that the labor market is efficient. So I think that's kind of my final word on labor demand. And maybe people can go into researching the nuances of what might lead to higher labor demand or what might lead to lower labor demand. But overall, I don't think it's that important for the discussion of basic income. So next week's discussion, we're talking about neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is an ideology. It's an approach to how we want to structure our economy and the world. The broadest sense of it is that we want to be able to set the parameters for markets such that they benefit people the most. But neoliberalism gets a lot of criticism, especially from people on the left who view it as there are some people who call themselves neoliberals or who maybe were using the neoliberal philosophy of getting markets to work towards the benefit of humanity and not doing it successfully. So it's gotten a bad reputation, but we'll talk about that, whether that reputation is deserved and whether basic income fits into the neoliberal picture, because basic income, obviously, it helps the markets work for the benefit of the people. And that's what neoliberalism is all about. So we'll talk about that next week.